another edition of Expanding Mind, continuing conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and I was thinking about a story a friend told me, who, she's into music, into underground experimental music, and a few bands she vaguely knew about, and they were participating in an outdoor festival on the West Coast. And she went to this, and it was like, you know, it was pretty great. It was, you know, kind of long-haired, post-hippie-ish, nature, pagan, mystical people. And the music was sort of trancey and experimental drones, acoustic instruments, very evocative, kind of mystical, intense music. And, you know, she was enjoying it. It's the kind of stuff she grew used to. And then at some point, a fellow took to the stage, and he began to sort of harangue and rant in a more or less explicitly political way that took on a disturbing tone, at least as far as my friend was concerned. And at some point, after having sort of roused the crowd, began gesturing in an explicitly fascist manner with a kind of a Sieg Heil, and though I don't think Sieg Heil itself was proclaimed, the vibe was clear what was going on. And my friend realized that what she had actually stumbled into or tapped into was a pretty underground West Coast phenomenon or scene that combined strong pagan, anti-Christian, back to nature, organic, hippie, local, white ideas and cultural associations with explicitly right-wing positions. So, and this scene does exist. It's complicated. It's difficult to generalize about because some of the people would reject the idea that these things are right-wing. But it's a very rich world. It certainly does not is not limited to the West Coast. In fact, there's much more of this activity in Europe. And today we're going to be talking particularly about the UK with Dr. Amy Hale, who is an anthropologist and also a participant observer in a variety of pagan and esoteric groups. And she teaches liberal arts at the Golden Gate University. It's been a fascinating and something sort of controversial recent piece about the right-wing tendencies of certain major figures that are embraced by pagans and witches and heathens and other folks trying to reconnect with the old ways. So we'll be talking about some of these tricky but very important issues. But before we bring Amy on, of course, our co-host here on Spain Mind, Maja Daru. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Maja.
So you were just in the woods for a week. Did you get down and dirty with the nature spirits?
I did. In fact, it's funny that we're talking about this now because right after I got back from the woods, I gave a lecture on the Nazis and occultism and kind of like basically the whole thing that was brought up in Amy's article, which is, you know, how did the Nazis form and do it? And it's, like you said, like a large part of it was this attempt to return back to the pagan cultures of nature. And, you know, one of the things that I really noticed in a lot of my research, people will look at that fascist movement and they'll see, but they forget the historical context. Like, why would this happen, right? And I think it's kind of like the Soviet Union and when it broke apart, like what was happening a little bit is how I see it. Because you have, like, look at Britain. They were all like these Druid, Celtic-y, sort of fairy kind of faith religions, and then all the Christianity comes in and just kind of takes over everything with these invading cultures, and then just says, okay, like now you're this. So then people are like, well, wait a minute, like we come from all this. So then they become these, you know, traditionalists, or they want to like reinstate their culture they came from, which is what the Nazis originally were trying to do. Like, they were using runes, they were using these things they said were Germanic history, and of course then it tailed off into anti-Semitism, which actually was President Jordan to come to the church, ironically.
Well, I mean, I think what you're pointing out is just the way that, just how tricky these things are, that if that it's really easy just to go, oh, the fascists are far over there, our worldview has nothing to do with them, but actually you start to see that they have similar roots in, as a California, you know, historian, the most direct predecessors for the hippies are the von der Vogelin movement in the late 19th century Germany, which were back to nature, nudists, esoteric, celebrated arts, romanticism, the irrational, and some of that material went directly into German fascism as well. So there's these things are much more complicated than I think we want them to be. And so now we have all these, we've raised all these complexities. Hopefully Amy can shed some light on these issues. So Amy, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Thank you. This is very exciting to be here.
Yeah. So, you know, it was a fascinating article. I know it's stirred up a lot of responses as well, because I think you shed some light on problems and complexities that maybe had been a little bit ignored. And I also know, as I say, that it's a very tricky, controversial area, and we have to be kind of careful with our language, because it's very easy, progressives and left-wing people do this all the time, where they simplify and demonize when talking about certain kinds of traditionalist or return to nature positions, and it's a tricky zone, and you don't want to tar and feather folks, and at the same time it's really serious stuff. So I thought one thing you did in your article that I would be helpful maybe here a little bit is to set things up with some language, perhaps telling us a little bit about what the new right is, and then a little bit about traditionalism, and then we can kind of play with how you show the connections between these things, particularly more recently.
Sure. I think that certainly in your setup, the way that you talked about the fact that we've got all of these ideas and cultural tropes that we today we associate with the left and the counterculture, and the fact that a lot of them have also run through what we consider to be kind of more right-wing or conservative movements. I think that's something that's really important to keep in mind, because that is going to come up again and again when we are discussing what's happening with the new right in particular, and some of the weird and interesting kind of political and cultural movements that have hived off of that, because they actually really resist categorization. Well, they don't resist categorization. They resist the kind of comfortable polarization that we frequently want to put on to these behaviors, these beliefs, these particular types of politics. So I know that when I've been when I discuss this with people, it's been extremely important for me, in particular, to talk about the term fascism and what academics mean by fascism and what they don't mean, because that in particular causes such a knee-jerk reaction, and there are such popular and populist ideas of what fascism means. So
yeah,
when I
talk such an easy term of abuse, kids who don't know their history in a demonstration, and the cops show up and they're like, fascist, you know, and it's totally rootless, and it doesn't help illuminate the trickiness of these situations. So feel free to help illuminate.
Yeah, because this is, you know, trying to when I discuss this with the general public, and I try to draw out these very very tricky category defining concepts. People obviously get upset whenever the F word. People get upset about it. But when I talk about fascism, I talk about a couple of things in specific. First is historical fascism. And historians, when we're talking about historical fascism, we are generally referring to these specific political movements that arose generally just after World War I,
and were embraced by specifically Italy and Germany, although there are some people who resist even calling the Nazis fascist. When I'm referring to it, I refer to historical fascism, and then contemporary fascism, neo-fascism, or crypto-fascism, which is categorized by a couple of different features. One is the idea that of what is called palingenetic ultranationalism, or the idea that that we will return to, or a specific nation needs to have a revolution to return to a golden age. We're going to see that idea come up again and again. The other thing about modern fascism movements is that they're undemocratic. There is generally embedded in there the idea that there is a natural hierarchy and or a caste system, and that we need to return to this kind of natural state where there will be one leader that will represent the mind and will of the people. And generally, pretty much much exclusively, it's a he, so let's call him he, because these movements tend to be very invested in the idea of a virile masculinity, and that there will be a leader who will rise up and enact the will of the people. So when I'm talking about modern fascist movements, those are really the ideas that I'm using that I think characterize a lot of these movements today. And so from there we can get into the specificity of why some of the things that I'm talking about have been thought of by myself and other scholars to be fascist, because obviously a lot of these people themselves don't want to, for various reasons, don't want to be identified as fascist, don't want to consider themselves to be fascist.
I just wanted to ask you a quick question, because this is something I think about a lot. When you say that would you restrict these to political movements in terms of like how fascism is looked at historically? Or do those include religious movements as well? Like, can that leader that takes anyone into a place, can that also be messianic? Like, that's what happened with Hitler, right? Is that he not only was the leader of the fascist movement, but then with the Nazis, as we know, it turned into a religion, the blood religion, and then Hitler was the messiah. So does it have to be like one or the other to technically be fascist, or how would you like differentiate that?
I personally do not. Now, there are, excuse me, I'm suffering from a bit of a cold here. I actually don't make that distinction, certainly in the context that we're talking about today, where we're talking about paganism and the use of religion and religious tropes in both culture and in political movements. I think that in these particular movements, in the new right, and in some manifestations of the new right, because new right really, it's a blanket term, but there are a lot of different types and flavors of movements that arise from the new right. There is kind of an interesting theocratic layer that emerges from this. And so a lot of people are actually seeing this in religious or quasi-religious terms. So I actually don't make the distinction. They use religion, they use culture, which we'll get into probably a little bit more later when we start probably talking about some of the music and other cultural manifestations that Eric was referring to at the beginning of the show. I think that these things are entwined together in a really interesting and challenging way.
I think we could say that, like, the new right are movements that in some ways try, and for some good reasons, to differentiate themselves, distinguish themselves from historical fascism, but mm-hmm. also carry on some of the currents, an emphasis on a kind of nationalism or even a racism, but not necessarily the same kind of way. I mean, let's hold off on the racist bit for a bit, because that's particularly complicated and tough to deal with. But there's also a sense of a resistance to modernity, an attraction to hierarchy, whether it's conceived naturally or because it's in light of some kind of structure of the cosmos, resistance to multiculturalism, to sort of gross industrial capitalism, et cetera, et cetera. So we can see this kind of movement, and I know it's very complicated and it's hard to generalize, but I think we got a good picture there. What can you give us a snapshot now of what traditionalism is, and particularly how it manifests in a figure that, as you say, we tend to think of as more of a countercultural, hippie-loving, pagan, groovy guy in the UK, John Michel. There were other characters like this in the States and other places, but he's sort of a very, for people who know him, he's a very powerful, charismatic figure, and again, someone we would think of as being in the more liberal camp, but he's a traditionalist in a way that's much more ambiguous. So give us a snapshot of traditionalism, if you will.
Sure. Because I think what ends up happening in the New Right, they kind of have adopted a lot of the precepts of traditionalism to create kind of a more overarching cultural and political movement. Traditionalism, we kind of see again, it's a post World War I movement that most people associate the origins of it with a philosopher called René Guénon, who had the idea that what the decayed society of the West needed in the wake of that terrible war, that we really needed to return to a perennialist vision, by which I mean that there is kind of one universal truth. There is one universal spiritual truth. There is one universal spiritual order. And that if Western society in particular, but if all societies really, can return to exploring that one universal truth, that the world will obviously be a more peaceful place, and that everything will kind of settle into its natural state, and it will reduce the idea, you know, that we need conflict and war. Everything will be in its nice, neat box. As you noted, the idea of anti-modernism is really key to understanding traditionalism. In traditionalism, there are a lot of people, you know, Prince Charles identifies as a traditionalist. Catherine Wayne, who was a well-known British poet, W.B. Yeats, these were all people who were absolutely self-identified as traditionalists, who were really trying to get back to ideals and structural forms of society that they thought were good and peaceful and that would be ordered. Traditionalists believed that human beings want essentially order, and that through order we have peace.
Yeah, and one really good example of that that gives some flesh to this idea, so that people can get a sense, especially who are familiar with modern spiritual and New Age currents, is the idea of sacred geometry. I mean, I had a friend who was part of who went to an art institute in the UK that specialized in sacred geometry. So there was a lot of material from Islamic design. Prince Charles was someone who was associated with the school and would show up on occasion. And the more that they hung out there, the more that they realized that it was actually a very, very conservative institution. But this idea of sacred geometry gives us, I think, almost like an aesthetic picture of traditionalism. The idea is that there are these forms in the universe that are universal, the circle and the relationships that come out of it, and number, and that when you start to explore that, you're actually getting to the language of universal order. And so if you're able to apply sacred geometrical principles to the structure of a house, to the nature of a landscape, to your art practices, you're tapping and you're organizing our messy, chaotic human life along the lines of these universal, platonic, quasi-mathematical sort of principles. So it's a very appealing notion. I mean, and it's produced a lot of different kinds of reactions, some of which are not at all traditionalist or conservative, but a lot of them also are traditionalist and conservative. And that's one place I think that if I remember correctly, that Jean-Michel also really shined. He was very interested in sacred geometry as an aspect of this kind of traditionalist mystical recovery of universal principles that seemed to appeal to hippies and nature lovers, but also appeal to people who are interested in these kind of universal forms of order as a way of organizing human life.
Absolutely, and I think that, you know, for a lot of people who are familiar with, say, you know, the Earth Mysteries Movement, the idea of ley lines, the idea that this would somehow be associated with forms of reactionary political movements is completely bizarre and very totally counterintuitive. But what you put your finger on, which is so important, is that the idea that we have these, you know, these universal mathematical structures which represent Platonic forms. I mean, a lot of what is being kind of recapitulated here with the politics is the idea of a strict Platonism, and that this order that we can find in the landscape, frequently the idea is that it was put there by some sort of priestly class who understood, you know, an elite who understood how these forms worked, that they represent not just a mathematical order, but also a social order, that can be replicated by taking certain steps like reintroducing a caste system and a sacred kingship.
Yeah, and that's where you get into really wacky stuff. I mean, reading your article, and I'm really sort of loosely familiar with Jean-Michel's work. I've read one or two books, but the whole attraction of the idea of the sacred king, which particularly for Americans, is like, what the heck is that? Like, we can't even, like, it's hard to wrap our heads around it. It's probably even hard for a lot of reactionaries to wrap their heads around it. But then when you start to think about it in terms of these, in this more religious or mystical framework, it makes sense. It's like there's a natural hierarchy in the universe. So the social order should mirror that hierarchy. I mean, this is something that was very important in traditional Indian society with the caste system, and still organizes their social reality in ways that confuse and challenge modern, you know, Western, whatever, developed civilizational kind of people.
Totally. One of the funniest ways to me where you can see that echo is in the Catholic Church. I mean, they got the Pope, right, who is the sacred king, and all the way down the line, the Church is organized through these hierarchical issues. And yet, when the Catholic Church, who's actually adhering to those kind of systems, goes into these fascist places, they have a freak out because it's, like, non-traditional. And that's what I always wonder about, is, like, how can you have all these different fascist groups with no unity within the fascists, right? So there are these, like you said, these sacred geometries and these underlying principles that are universal, and any kind of fascist or traditionalist group thinks that, then they should understand. You can see it. And even these, you know, modern things like the Catholic Church, but I feel like the West could understand those things better if they knew that you can see it everywhere, like even in our church system. So,
and you hit on some interesting points there. René Guénon was advocating in terms of, you know, his program. This is the earliest traditionalist there. That what he believed would be an excellent solution for the West would be to return to the theocracy of Orthodoxy, of Christian Orthodoxy, or strict Catholicism. Ultimately, what he ended up moving into was Islam. And so you see, he became a Muslim, and he really advocated Islam as probably the best way to reinforce some of these traditionalist notions. And so you end up in some forms of Islamic activism, seeing these principles being played out a lot more specifically and explicitly. They're here in the West. They're all over the place. But we don't always recognize traditionalism as the actual political and philosophical movement that it is, and the influence that it's had. And the other point, which is fascinating about what the new right is doing right now, it's always been argued by scholars of fascism that fascism, because of its very ultranationalist flavor, has not been able to have a universalist movement. You know, a lot of these principles are seen to be very culturally specific, which, again, when we start talking about the racism stuff, we'll get into their idea of how that works. But what the new right is doing is actually very, very creatively, by using these ideas of these universal principles, which are replicated on a very local level, they're creating a universalist framework for fascist movements, which is really very innovative. And I will say that they are absolutely brilliant strategists, and that they are hitting on some pulse points, some cultural and political pulse points across the West right now, both in Europe and in the United States, that are resonating with people. They're resonating with people who are tired of a traditional right-left divide, and whom the idea of going back to something which appears to be simple, which appears to be anti-materialist, which seems to have family values and cultural values and community values, these things are very, very appealing to
well,
the
one
right
another
now.
Another way that this stuff started to make more sense to me when I was trying to figure out how could these things that have been associated with progressive countercultural things also contain this kind of conservatism is this idea of anti-modernism. And that sounds kind of abstract, but I think, you know, everyone can relate with at some point going like, wow, this modern industrial system of so-called democracy and representational government with a lot of increasingly abstract capitalist industrial development and the replacement of traditional life ways with popular culture and, you know, American TV and, you know, that whole thing, it's got some serious problems, and we're all aware of that. And the more you tune into the part of you that looks at all that as kind of a mistake, for a deeply screwed up situation or something that was false in its assumptions, the more that you can start to tap into the ways that people on the so-called left and people on the so-called right share a sort of disgust and horror with aspects of the sort of system that we've developed, particularly since the 19th century, but in some ways since modernity, since we started, you know, on the road of representational government and capitalism, global capitalism, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a way in which I think we can kind of relate to that. And in addition, maybe 1950, you had a decent case to make for the new global order as being something that would maybe keep strife at bay, that maybe it wasn't the best system, but it was, you know, better than what we had before. But it's pretty hard to be pro-global, industrial, quote-unquote, democratic capitalism these days. So I think we can all relate to what's appealing, at least superficially, about some of these claims, which is part of what I think makes these things difficult. Well, actually, I've been ranting here, and now we have to take a break. So we'll come back and talk with Amy more about this fascinating, really important topic. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daru, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. We're here today talking about fascism. I know, like Amy said, people have knee-jerk reactions. We're here with Eric Davis and Amy Neal, and we're talking about how fascism contributes or interacts with a lot of the pagans and traditionalists and all that kind of stuff. And We might as well bring up race and talk about that a little bit. One of the things that I've always found hilarious in my research in this department is that people get so uptight about the race issue, but it's all just, you know, hypocrisy. Can you look, take the Nazis, for example, right? They're a nationalist group. They want to return to their culture. They want to, you know, reinstill these traditional values of the area. And, you know, one of the cultures they pick on the most, although certainly not only ones, are the Jews, who are very well known for being extremely traditionalist and trying to keep their culture and keep those, like, universalist themes and study it, although some people complain they're a little exclusionary, although I don't really think, I haven't found that to be true in my experience. But, so, the Nazis, you know, pick them out because they say they're parasites on the culture. And then the Nazis go and they invade all these other countries and become parasites on their culture. So I always think it's funny when people are like, well, no, we have to be traditionalists and to our race, but then somehow, inevitably, they become interested in taking over all these other races, even though they have nothing to do with their own traditional values. And then it becomes this, you know, thing to see, like, well, whose traditional values will win. I mean, how do you see the issue of race in it from, like, a bird's eye point of view?
That's definitely it's a very complicated question. I will say, so my doctorate is in folklore, and I consider myself to be an anthropologist, and I've worked with ethno-nationalist movements in the UK for over 20 years. So this is kind of, you know, when I look at the frameworks of how we talk about things like race and ethnicity, frankly, I think that folklore as a field has got a lot to answer for in this respect because, you know, it grew out of this idea that there are separate ethnicities which are, you know, I use the phrase bounded and organic, and that they are tied to a particular territory, particular land,
right.
And that there is, that, you know, there's this supposition that we can get back to this, that anybody has a pure race or culture, and, you know, this is how anthropology and folklore fields kind of grew out of this really very flawed and incorrect notion. We know that culture doesn't work like that. We know that race is not an operative concept. And unfortunately, these ideas which kind of underpin these sciences of culture are really locked in the populist consciousness, and they underpin nationalist movements. And also, you know, kind of on the left, lovely, I think, cultural preservationist instincts. Mm. Well, actually, the cultural preservationist instincts cross right and left, but I can talk about that more in a minute. Unfortunately,
well, I think you're very right about the territory role. I mean, obviously, you can see that just in Israel-Palestine stuff, but the territory issue is kind of a big thing too, in addition to the folk movement stuff. Yeah.
Well, what we end up with then are the nasty blood and soil arguments that we end up getting for, you know, essentially German Nazism, and but also the foundation for a lot of various ethno-nationalisms. And we know that as models of culture, they're deeply, deeply problematic. There aren't pure cultures. There are always hybrids. The idea that you need to keep things that we have, that nations are of, you know, biology, culture, I see is actually works more like a biological adaptation. And we also know that in biological systems, the things that are the most pure are actually the most weak. your mutt dog is probably more likely to be more hardy than your, you know, sweet little purebred. And so this idea, this kind of, it's a very, very romanticized notion that there is any kind of pure culture to get back to. However, in the paradigms of the new right, the way forward is to return to, again, the strictly Platonic ideal that you have that each territory has a pure culture, and that the way to, and this is where it gets kind of interesting, the way to actually preserve diversity is through promoting the idea of a pure culture. So basically, everybody needs to kind of get back to their own people and stick with their own kind, and that in doing so, we will promote diversity throughout the planet.
Well, that's what I see, like, the biggest joke, like you were saying, like, that's what they promote, and yet then the cultures that are the biggest for promoting that go out and take over every other culture in the world.
Well,
right?
I think it's important. Yeah, I think it's actually important, and this is a good example of a place where it's just as important to distinguish the difference between historical fascism and particularly the kind of expansionist, even imperialist vision of Germany as being like a new empire, essentially a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, except without the Pope, without holiness.
Right.
You know, where it's such a profound civilization that it has the right to, like, conquer. What we have now with the New Right is, a multicultural influenced version. So it's more like, No, that's fine. You guys get your territory too. It's not an expansionist mode, at least in some of its expressions. Instead, it's like, no, what we need to do is localize.
Yeah.
You know, you return to the locality. And that's where it gets so weird because, you know, anyone listening to this is familiar and probably drawn to ideas of locality, of buying food locally, supporting local businesses, understanding your bioregion, and the one that really gets me, this is very interesting because it's more complicated than people tend to take it, is the way in which people who are interested in the restoration of the, landscape and particularly flora. So I live in California. There's a big native Californian flora movement that's been around for decades. These are people who go in and I want to redo my lawn and I want to get rid of all the non-indigenous plants. I want it to be what was here before. And obviously there's a whole politics to that that's very similar to what we're talking about. Doesn't mean that these people are at all fascist in any other way, but there's something very appealing about that story. Now, I think that example is particularly interesting because I understand it still. Like, it's not, you know, because some people, there was a big kerfuffle in The Guardian about a month ago with people taking different positions on the native plants. And, of course, you have these, also the sort of typical leftist response where they come in and say, look, this is clearly the language of racism, it's the language of nationalism, it's trying to imagine some romantic world without multiculturalism and the international order, and you're like, well, yeah, okay, but, like, I still understand why people want to have, like, native grasses rather than the ones that came with, you know, 100 years ago or whatever. Like, it makes sense to me why that would be something that you would want or enjoy or aestheticize. So it's partly to point to the way in which some of this New Right stuff just goes, it overlaps feelings and desires and healthy responses that people have to our current condition, which is part of what makes it so dizzying and also so disturbing when you, as you point out in your article, and I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about this, is that how recently, over the last decade or so, that the New Right has been much more crafty about putting forward some of its, in many ways, racist as well as, you know, anti-democratic ideas in the guise of a kind of localism, nativism, organic, earth-based, you know, cultural family, you know, these very appealing values. And I really love to hear how you even think about that situation, and particularly, frankly, how you navigate yourself. I mean, how you see the appeal, you see the extraordinarily serious consequences. You see how it moves through cultures that you're very familiar with, paganism and esotericism. So I'd love to hear you riff on that appeal, the use of the appeal.
Sure. It's publishing that article, and, you know, kind of, I've got some more things that are coming out which might make people even more mad. It was really tricky because it hit so many emotional spots for people. And a lot of people, I've also discovered, it's very hard for them to read, to actually pull out what I'm trying to say. And so the way that I'm talking about it is, instead of saying paganism is fascist, or wanting to return to native landscapes is fascist, because there are a lot of people who are going to hear that and they're going to make that equation. What I'm trying to get across to folks is a sure salient frameworks. It doesn't mean that because Prince Charles identifies as a traditionalist, that Prince Charles is a fascist. It's important to get across that these ideas have things in common, and that there are particular expressions of them that can go in a particularly politicized way. I had one person who read that piece and who responded, in a British guy, who literally came out and was like, Amy Oral hates folklore and folk music and King Arthur and thinks they're all fascist. And it's like, no, I love these things, and that's not what I'm saying. But there is such an emotional knee-jerk around this. And it's because of those shared frameworks of tradition, of folklore, of tribalism, of wanting to basically get out of the mess that we're in. These are counter, a lot of these are strictly, you know, we see them in America and also in Britain as being countercultural values. And because they are shared frameworks with the New Right are finding opportunities to come in and through publishing and through music and through festivals to be able to say, hey, you might want to check this out. Here are some tracks on really, really, really radical environmentalism and neo-tribalism that you might find appealing.
Yeah, I think it's just it's really a key to get the complexity of the situation out there. And it's just so unfortunate. I'm sure you've been at the brunt of this in the response. It's just we have this terrible tendency in public discourse to polarize and to simplify or literalize a complex situation. Politics is complicated, spirituality is complicated, environmentalism is complicated. It's a complex world, and it polarizes really, really easily. And I think that that's also a little bit part of the solution, quote unquote, to the problem, which is like, if for people who are drawn to these things, who aren't aware of this, and they find out about it, is it like, does it mean they're fascists? What's going on here? No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Just because it's more complicated, and actually, it's funny, we had mentioned, anti-Semitism, and we certainly think about some of these problems outside of the context of paganism, partly in terms of, like, Jewish question, the Jewish identity, and particularly the politics of Israel. What I was reminded of is a very significant class I had in college. It was a class in the Bible as literature, and it was taught by a fellow who had gotten rabbinic training. So it was, serious practicing Jew, but he was a literary theorist and a professor of English. And in a way, the whole class was about understanding and appreciating and really taking in the Jewish idea of a homeland, that organizes identity, it organizes politics, it organizes the spiritual life in a lot of ways, but at the same time, that homeland was not literal. It was not in a place. It was not on the West Bank. It was not in Israel. And that the problem and the politics comes in when people took this vision and attempted to literalize it. That is, to be simple about it. Like, that means that God said, we get this, acre, and so you guys, we have divine right to kick you guys out. And he adamantly opposed to that. So in a way, something from the spirit that was worked out, that part of what I think needs to happen is that people have to recognize the value and the affirmative possibilities of some of these ideas and the vision of a different kind of order, even a different way of being in society and being in relationship to nature, but at the same time to always, always remain critically aware of the tendency to want to simplify, literalize, draw stark boundaries that make you feel comfortable, that we don't get that. We don't get that these days. You gotta embrace the mess. And so that's what I see your work doing. But Masha, you were gonna ask.
Yeah, it's totally true. I completely agree. I feel like that's like a main brunt of the problem, and you can see it in the Nazis, how they literally interpreted some things that, you know, that was not what it was meaning. And you can pick, like, multiple things, like, in their philosophy where you can see that's extremely the case. And that, like you said, Eric, is the same mindset that contributes to, like, manifest destiny. And you can see it happen over and over and over again. So that, we have to look to that solution, like you said, like, it's not a small deal. It's kind of a big deal, because the way that contributes to philosophy is people just not paying attention is really devastating on many, many cultures.
And it's very difficult. And Eric, you asked how it is that I navigate some of this stuff personally. A lot of my work for the past couple of decades has actually been academic work on a particular indigenous nationalist movement in the UK, which embodies a lot of these principles. They certainly would never see it that way, and, you know, most of my dear friends and colleagues over there would be absolutely mortified, although they are also very aware of the potential for these ideas to go in a really very right-wing direction. And when I think about the principles, the things that I love and the things that I believe in, and when they kind of go over into this yucky space, well, it's not the yucky space, it's that there is the shared framework and the associations with which I find uncomfortable. And, you know, I have a number of friends, for example, who are really drawn to neo-folk music, the neo-folk aesthetic. And what I'm trying to do is not say, that's all bad. What I try to do with people is say, first, we have to be more sophisticated about how we think about these things. We need to be aware of what the potential political implications for some of them are.
Right.
And then also, follow the money train.
Yeah.
So for me, it's really important. I am very, very, very careful about what I say. I don't say that something, for example, is white nationalist unless I have absolute proof that it is being funded by people who believe explicitly in white nationalism, or they themselves identify specifically as white nationalists. I do not, you know, I won't do that. I can say these views can potentially be in support of a white nationalist cause. That's very different, and we need to start promoting the sophistication of understanding when, you know, X is not Y, but X can lead to Y. I know that people again will get very upset by this idea that, you know, when I say that some of these things are in fact fascist, but I try to be very discriminating when I use that phrase. And still, we've got a lot of people out there saying, well, you know, fascists are racist, or fascists are all anti-Semitic. And these people aren't anti-Semitic. It's like, no, they're actually using a much more sophisticated understanding of what they're trying to do there.
Yeah.
And we need to, I think, in the pagan and esoteric communities, we need to elevate the level of discourse. We need to get smarter about this stuff. And because the way these people work, and the way that paganism works, is through emotional appeal.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. It's because I think part of the difficulty of the issue is that it's one thing to train people to think more about concepts and intellectual claims. But what also has to happen, and it's harder, is you actually have to train your emotions. You have to recognize that even a profound feeling of homecoming, of resonance, of affected community, where you're, you know, that all of those emotions, which are so clearly delicious, essential to human being, or at least feel like they're essential to human being, are also themselves potentially very problematic. And it doesn't mean you can go through them, but it also means that you're even, the fact that you have some experience of total connection and resonance and wonderful affective bonding with a people or a place or a ritual doesn't mean that it's good medicine.
That's a really, really good point. Or that that those feelings are essential and real, and that they're the same for everybody. And we want to believe that, because you know, when we have these feelings, and you know, they come from all sorts, all manner of ecstatic experience, and because these movements tend to be ecstatically based, because they tend to rely on rhetoric involving the senses, that which is non-rational or extra-rational, very specifically. They do that so that when you feel something that real, that you will say, this must be truth.
Yeah, well, and a lot of it reminds me of the novel by Thomas Wolfe, you know, The Colored Angel, or You Can't Go Home Again. That idea that, you know, people respond to it emotionally. Those emotions are driven by the same microcosms that run families, right? If you look at any nation or race or traditional cultural value, you see the same things on a smaller level of each individual involved in your family. And that idea, even that you could go back to the homeland that Eric was talking about, is psychologically and emotionally what all that stuff is kind of drawing on in people. And I feel like you said, if we can deal with that, then it'll make a little bit more progress. But because people don't address that and we keep it on this reactionary emotional level, we're never going to get anywhere.
Yeah, it's true. And one of the things that I try to do when I'm unpacking this, particularly for pagans and also for folks in the esoteric community, I think that one thing that's really important is to critique this idea of tradition. Mm. And what does tradition mean? What is a traditional culture? I don't use that term in my work. I find it deeply problematic. I think that it assumes that there are cultures that have been, you know, untouched by time, which is just not true. And you know, and it brings up this idea of the noble savage, which kind of underpins a lot of this stuff too, and which makes me really uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've come to is to really embrace the term indigenous to be able to describe certain what you might also call traditional cultures that are still in the land where they've been for thousands or tens of thousands of years. Australian Aboriginals are a great example. They are an indigenous people. The people in the Native Americas are indigenous people, even if they've been moved around and screwed over in a million different kinds of ways, so that you can reserve something that serves the function of traditional about certain peoples. Now, that term indigeneity does not, against whatever the New Right people want to say, apply to Swedes. You know, mm-hmm. It's not, you know, even though there have been people there for a long time, you can't refer to them as indigenous at this point. That is just not correct. And then if you try to use the word tradition instead, you're just not paying attention to history. You're just not aware of how much these things have been constructed, particularly in the 19th century. So, you know, and it's a shame because in a way sometimes you feel like the spoiler at the party because you have all these people who are, you know, seduced and sort of enjoying this kind of vision of some current of tradition that's passed through millennia and that they're the recipient of it and it empowers them and whatever. And it's wonderful. I think that initiation can occur, you know, in all sorts of ways. But to then map that onto actual historical development, to ignore the way that nationalism and identity get constructed in the 19th century through precisely the recovery of folklore and traditional methods and da 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 da, we can't we don't get that. It's like, sorry, Bob, you know, we gotta, you know, that's your, you gotta like go through that fire to, in my view. So anyway, we just have a few minutes here, and I want to let you direct people to any of your place they could find out more of your work online, or just to talk about the other work that you have coming up that people can keep a lookout for.
Wow, thanks. This particular article that you are referring to on John Michel is from a recent issue of Pomegranate, which is an academic journal. Right now, I don't have a whole bunch out there that is as accessible as I would like it to be. I think it's really important that we widen the discussion about this, just in the general public, in the pagan community, in the wider esoteric community. A number of my pieces actually can be found under academia.edu, which is a site that is, I believe, open to folks. You have to register for it, but it's kind of like the Facebook for academics. I have a number of my pieces up on there. I think that, you know, I'm glad that this issue has had such a response, and that there are people who are starting to figure out how we can talk about this, how can we think that part of the challenge is going to be being able to have a good, rational, adult informed discussion about this and still be able to feel the wonderful, yummy, delicious magic stuff about our spiritual paths.
So thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you. This has been great.
All right, from me and Maj and all you out there, keep your minds open.